Dirty hands means clean theology. Can you dig it?
What is going on, all my local guys and gals and long distance pals?
We are back.
We're back.
You ruined it. I'm sorry. That wasn't nice, was it?
That was an inside joke anyway.
It's been a while.
It has been a while. We're back, as Justin likes to sing, in the saddle again. So.
That's right.
As we're looking at a saddle.
We've been off for a little bit just with sports and so many other things happening for our kids and other things going on. We've all been very, very, very busy, but things are going in a positive direction. Justin's still plugging along with Prometheus Lens. He keeps putting out good quality content. Please check in. The girls have been still going along with the Mustard Seed Podcast. Look it up. Get involved. And as far as the dig and some of the other things that we're doing kind of on the side, we're working towards a documentary coming out hopefully in the next year, but the recording for What Are the Chances is going to start end of July. We have a trip that we're taking. We wish Ben would come with us, but it didn't happen. But me, Justin, and Sean will be down in with my mother and my brother. We'll be down in Texas shooting on scene or on site, I should say, with working on that What Are the Chances documentary, and it's going to be amazing. So get excited for all the projects coming up, the things that are going on right now. It's a lot happening. And always tune into the Muddy Piston Garage, of course.
Oh, yeah.
Sorry, I don't want to leave you out of there,
Ben. Well, hold on. You might as well start plugging in what's your little... The smoking deal and all them other things that you're talking about.
Smoking
start.
Deal.
You started smoking?
No. Smoking meat, something with Big Sexy.
Oh, we'll get there. We're not there yet.
Oh, you're not there. Sorry.
We'll get there. We'll get there soon. There's a couple other things that are going to happen here shortly. But
yeah, I remember you saying something about that.
A couple other shows.
I didn't know it wasn't.
That are all going to be founded, you know, biblically in the background that we are. They're going to be good quality, wholesome shows that that reach a different demographic, but are things that you'll enjoy coming up. And yes, Ben did call him Big Sexy.
That's his nickname in the Muddy Pissing Garage.
That's my
father-in-law. His name's also Ben. So
the Ben and Ben Show.
I've been calling him Big Sexy, and he's kind of like a John Wayne character.
He really is.
He does not like
stoic.
Being called Big Sexy, so it just makes it even that much better.
Yeah, so you lay it on thicker.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Well, he's an amazing guy. And he's been huge.
He takes it pretty good, but he's like, ugh.
He's been a blessing to all of us, too. So it's been great having him around. But we're moving. I tell you what, this whole family of shows and different things that are happening keeps getting bigger. It keeps growing. And, man, it's just something that God keeps pushing forward. So I'm happy. I'm proud to be part of it. I think that you guys will be pretty amazed with what you see in the future and the gamut that this will run. And it all started actually in the back of a gym with four of us sitting there talking on mics almost 4 years ago, 3.5 years ago. So
it's crazy.
It's crazy to think about. But
then,
it just
then
keeps
to
growing.
A garage and then down into my basement.
Into the basement next to the saddle.
Next to the
that we're back
Western
in again.
Saddle.
That we're yeah. back in again. Well, did you guys see that I've actually hooked up with the Wyatt family, Ron Wyatt's family?
I have been seeing that.
I've been beside myself. I've been like a little kid in a candy store.
You had
a candy store.
Wife on there the other day. I saw.
Well, see, I got hooked up. A listener of my show reached out and was like, "Hey, I know William Wyatt, Ron Wyatt's brother. Would you like to talk to him?" I was like, "Oh yeah, man." So I got his number and we talked and I met him and he done like a presentation and I recorded it and put it out. And then he was like, he brought sulfur balls from Sodom and Gomorrah from Ron's collection and stuff. And I was just getting to hold them. I was like, "Can I touch them?" He's like, "Yeah, you can touch them." And I was looking at him, man. And I guess he just saw how excited I was. And he was like, "Ah, just take that one." I was like, "Dude, are you for real?" He's like, "Yeah, take it." Dude, I hugged him. And he was like, man, if you get this excited, he said, you need to come with me to Mary Nail's house. And my jaw dropped. I was like, I would love to go. And it was like the next weekend, he called me up. Hey, what are you doing this weekend? I'm like, I don't know, but I can drop everything. Let's go. So I got to hold a piece of Noah's Ark. Man, I seen giant finger bones. All kinds of cool stuff that they got down in that basement that up all of Ron's stuff. That was really cool.
That's amazing. That's a cool stuff. He left quite a legacy with all the things that he did and the exploration. And, you know, they're doing new testing on that Dupinar site that a lot of people believe, you know, there's been thoughts that originally Ron had originally thought that was the Ark site. And then a lot of people afterwards kind of said they disproved that to a degree. But apparently new scans are showing totally different things.
Yeah. Three tiers, like the Bible says. It's the same length as the Bible, man. There's a whole lot of coincidences if it's not. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yeah. So I'll tell you, I think, in my personal opinion, I think one of the reasons that we'll never truly find the physical Ark, like the actual wood in place, I mean, partially you think about how old that would be, but you could still find that petrified. However, the reason we won't is because it's by our faith alone. In the end, we have to have faith. You can't just have something that's the easy free ticket to say, oh yeah, that obviously happened. I think we have enough other proof and things around us that show us, you know, we don't need all those other things to say it. I mean, I just can look outside, look at the trees and know that God is real. But when you see, you know, if all of a sudden there's just a gigantic boat that's the exact dimensions of the Ark. I mean, I'm sure they would somehow try to wait.
Non-believers ain't going
to
believe. You could hit them with the absolute evidence, and they'd still be like, oh, that was faked, or that was this or that. No, I still don't believe it.
Well, now, if you show anybody on a video, you could just say it's AI, and it's hard to tell anymore. You can't tell what's real and what's fake anymore. So it's kind of a scary thing that way, but, yeah.
With that, me and Keish is watching one of them. I forget the name of the YouTube channel, but it's like archaeologist, biblical guy who's mm-hmm. over in Israel doing all this stuff. He goes to Egypt, and they've already found the tomb. I can't remember the guy's name, the Pharaoh's name, but they go to look and blah blah blah. They have to like pay some guy some shady stuff to get it unlocked to go look, and it was actually like when Moses was in Egypt, and the plagues that killed all the firstborn, his son was buried in like a little side chamber, and then where he had all like the boils all over him. When this Pharaoh was buried, he had like bubbles all over his skin on his neck and stuff that was exposed. And they think that that was actually the Pharaoh that was, because it don't say the name.
Yeah.
But, and we'll get to that in Exodus whenever we get to that book. But, you know, it was pretty interesting. He's like, here's the proof. Yeah. I mean, here he is, you know. The daddy was the one that was, what was it?
Ramses?
The one that was, heck fire, what was that? The coat of many colors?
Oh, Joseph.
Joseph.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so Joseph's son, you know, when he was the king and all that, oh, you've done so much stuff. The father of that was alive, was ruling when Joseph's son and all that was there. Well, he died, so the next Pharaoh didn't know what all the Israelite people's done for Egypt. So, you know, then they enslaved them and blah, blah, blah. It was pretty interesting.
That is interesting. I like those stuff, those historical things. I don't find that much different than the things that we do ultimately, because a lot of it, you know, we take the proof that we're given, the factual stuff we're given, and we just take the next step on a lot of things just to say, well, this is potentially what could have happened here. This is potentially right. What could have happened here.
I mean, so I don't know the name, cool. But the father, sir, was like a Pharaoh for 50 something years, and then he died. So, and then he was Pharaoh for however many long. And that was, they said something about when Moses was cast away, when this Pharaoh died, then that was when Moses was able to come back. Because now the new Pharaoh didn't know Moses. So he was safe to come back and to do what Moses did.
And he did some stuff.
Yeah, he did some.
He did some stuff.
Dropping some serpents.
He killed a guy.
He did kill a guy. That kind of started it all off, didn't it?
That kind of what made him leave. But did, you know. Yeah.
Well, I hope you guys enjoy all that and the banter that we have and all the projects and all the things coming up, because it's pretty awesome, all the things that are happening. I'm just blessed to be part of it. I know it's something that's beyond us, but I'm just blessed to be part of it, and I know these guys feel the same way. But today, we're going to continue on with our trek through Genesis. We're going to try to get through three chapters today, because I think there's a couple that we'll get through. I think 11 and 12, I think we'll get through relatively quickly, but 13 opens up a whole can of worms. So, I'm sorry, 14 opens a whole can of worms, not 13. I think 12 and 13 we'll get through quickly, and 14 opens a can of worms. But if you guys are ready, we'll jump in. We'll read through 12, kind of see what we find there.
Let's get ready to Bible
study.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So Genesis chapter 12. The Lord had said to Abram, "Leave your native country, your relatives, and your father's family, and go to a land that I will show you. I will make you into a great nation. I will bless you and make you famous, and you will be a blessing to others. I will bless those who bless you and curse those who treat you with contempt. All families on earth will be a blessing through you." So Abram departed as the Lord had instructed, and Lot went with him. Abram was 75 years old when he left Haran. He took his wife Sarai, his nephew Lot, and all his wealth, his livestock, and all the people he had taken into his household at Haran, and headed to the land of Canaan. When they arrived in Canaan, Abram traveled throughout the land as far as Shechem. There he set up camp beside the Oak of Moreh. At that time, the area was inhabited by the Canaanites. Then the Lord appeared to Abram and said, "I will give you this land to your descendants." And Abram built an altar there and dedicated it to the Lord, whom had appeared to him. After that, Abram traveled south and set up camp in the hill country with Bethel to the west and Ai to the east. There he built another altar and dedicated it to the Lord, and he worshiped the Lord. Then Abram continued traveling south by stages toward the Negev. At that time, there was a severe famine that struck the land of Canaan, forcing Abram to go down to Egypt, where he lived as a foreigner. As he was approaching the border of Egypt, Abram said to his wife Sarai, "Look, you are very beautiful. You are a very beautiful woman. When the Egyptians see you, they will say, 'Look, is this his wife? Let us kill him and we can have her.' So please tell them you are my sister. Then they will spare my life and treat me well because of their interest in you." And sure enough, when Abram arrived in Egypt, everyone noticed Sarai's beauty. When the palace officials saw her, they sang her praises to the Pharaoh, their king, and Sarai was taken into his palace. Then Pharaoh gave Abram many gifts because of her: sheep, goats, cattle, male and female donkeys, male and female servants, and camels. But the Lord sent terrible plagues upon Pharaoh and his household because of Sarai, Abram's wife. So Pharaoh summoned Abram and accused him sharply. "What have you done to me?" he demanded. "Why didn't you tell me she was your wife? Why did you say, 'She is my sister,' and allow me to take her as my wife? Now then, here is your wife. Take her and get out of here." Pharaoh ordered some of his men to escort them, and he sent Abram out of the country along with his wife and all his possessions. And that's chapter 12.
Damn, if I ain't screwed up.
There's a lot. I mean, not a lot in that one, but there's some.
Oh, there's some there. Really good nuggets in there that there I think that nuggets. A lot of people skim over. And when we look at this. We, you know, it's been a while since we'd done our last episode, so just a crash course refresher. The chapter before was the Tower of Babel. And remember, it says not only the tongues were divided, the nations, the peoples was divided amongst the sons of God, the B'nai HaElohim. But he said, but Jacob, Israel, is my allotted portion. And here, right after, Abraham is called out. And what does he say? He says, in your name, or through your name, all nations shall be blessed. So it's a promise and a prophecy of the coming Christ. It's going to break the strongholds of the enemies and break down the walls for his children to come back into his fold if they so choose. So I think that's a really profound thing that a lot of people seem to skim over.
Right in the beginning, you see that right away. This is talking Jews and Gentiles in the future, not just the Hebrews at the time. This is talking all nations, like you said. And I think that's a really important way to bring that in there for sure. I think it's interesting. He goes, and this is initially, we get down a little further. It says, I will give this land to your descendants. So this is the land of Canaan that he sets in, right? The Canaanites are there. This is eventually the promised land that the Hebrews come back to.
Yeah.
He's in the land of Canaan. And I think that it's just kind of interesting where he's promising the land he's in, but this is later. There's so much turmoil that they put themselves through because they don't listen to God as we get back and get through the Exodus. But you see, this is kind of that initial covenant with Abram where he's saying, this is, you know, this, the, we always talk about the Mosaic covenant, but there's the covenant of Abraham was kind of the start. I mean, you can go back to the covenant he made with Adam and Eve, but when he's talking about Abraham, this is talking about the Hebrew people. This is kind of the initiation, like you said, post Tower of Babel. And the other kind of weird part about this that I think is interesting is a little later, Pharaoh knows. He goes right away and says he knows somehow he found out that was his wife. So either somebody told him.
Well, Dr. Michael Heiser, I loved his take on it, man. He said that with the Hebrew and stuff breaking it down, he said that he believed that the affliction that they were caused, it talks about plagues or an affliction, was that they were impotent. They couldn't get an erection. That they tried to do their fertility rites and mess with Sarai, and they couldn't. And they knew that, you know, this woman was not to be touched.
It was a breakdown of the Hebrew?
Yeah, that's what Mike Heiser did a whole episode on his Dig Bible Podcast. Shoot, not Dig Bible Podcast.
Yes!
You know what I'm talking about.
Naked Bible.
Yes, Naked Bible. But he said that it could easily be interpreted as like a phallic problem, and that's why they knew she was spoken for. So we can't touch her. We've never been able to not perform before, and now we can't. So return her.
So I guess the thing that I think could, and that's, I mean, that could be very true. I don't know, obviously, but thing I think is interesting, and you brought it up, is this is directly after the Tower of Babel, right? So everybody at the Tower of Babel knew who God was. They were confounded, you know, all this thing, their languages and everything was there. Right after this, different people, and we don't know the gap of time exactly. I mean, we could look at the genealogies and figure out a little bit of gap here, but we see right away. So at this time in Egypt, this is not so far down the road of the telephone game and all these different things where they wouldn't have known who God was still, and maybe they were still worshiping the one true God at that point, even in Egypt, right? They go through the Tower of Babel. You leave out of there. You knew. I mean, there was people that were rebelling against God at that time, but he smites them. And what does it happen every time in Exodus when something happens and something terrible happens to his people? They turn back to him. So he confounds their languages. What if all these people and all these different nations turn back to God? And that's how every nation is started, is still founded in who the one true God Yahweh is. But over time,
the names change.
The names change. The peoples change. The sons of God, the B'nai HaElohim, they want the worship for themselves. So we see a bastardization, a mutation of it throughout history. But initially, they all believe in God. So even then, maybe he's praying to God, and God tells him, "Hey, that's his wife.
Yeah,
you can't do that," because he knew without Abraham telling him. He told Sarah not to tell anybody. I mean, one of his servants or somebody could have screwed up and said something. Who knows? But to me, it's just interesting to see that this is right after. They still would have known who God, this isn't, they're not so separated from who God was to them that they, in Egypt, still might have been worshiping the one true God at that point.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. But I just think that's interesting because of the timeline and how that fits in.
Yeah.
So we don't know, but I think that that's, it's just interesting. But the fact that he tells him, and the funny thing is when he tells him, says, say you're my sister, he's really not lying. She's his half-sister.
Right.
Right?
Yep.
So it's not a lie.
It's a card stack. That's what I like to say.
A card stack.
It's not a lie, but it's not the full truth.
That's exactly it. He tried to hedge his bets there.
Yeah.
But
the right questions are important, ladies.
So me and Keish was watching that whatever Genesis, that YouTube channel where the archaeologist guy, and they just did the thing about Bethel and Ai. And I can't remember who was the one that attacked them. But it looks like the towns are mentioned in later on in Genesis 28, it says. It's mentioned in Ezra, in Nehemiah. But Joshua attacked the town of Ai, and they sent a runner to Bethel, and they drew him out, and then they pretty much drawed him away, and they had another, you know, a separate group of guys that were hiding that then burnt Ai. And still today, it's just ruins.
Mm-hmm.
But I just found that interesting that, I mean, 2 days ago, we were watching this. And then Bethel and I was like, oh, interesting.
The synchronicity, that stuff all lines up.
And it even proves that these towns were real towns, you know. And it, I guess in the book of Joshua, it goes into greater detail of they piled rocks on the main gate and this and that. And they found a rock pile. And when they excavated it, there was foundations of the main gate sitting there. It was just interesting that they're proving the Bible to be true.
Oh yeah.
Over, you know, which is,
so there's nothing in archaeology that's ever gone against
disproving
the Bible,
yeah,
disprove the Bible. As a matter of fact, they're finding what's that stela that has King David's name on it? I can't remember the name of that, but there's all different things that they're finding. Different, the names of certain people, that, you know, different talks about the Israelites and different things that they're finding in these in these archaeological digs. And it's just everything falls into line. You know, you've talked about it before, the way they found Jericho and how even the jars of grain were burnt.
Yep.
And you don't do that. You take the resources. But what they said says to light fire to the whole thing. And sure enough, they did.
And that was the same here in the town of, or the little village of Ai. They burnt everything, and then they found a charcoal layer,
mm-hmm,
where everything was burnt. It's pretty, it's just wild.
Or the Sodom and Gomorrah thing with the brimstone and the sulfur that they find there when they go
actually
to that
find the, yep.
So, I mean, it just continues to show biblical accuracy.
It's a true historical.
This is a history
group
book.
Of books. Yeah.
This is a history book. The Bible is not only our faith, but it's a history book.
His story.
Oh, it is. It's boom. His story.
Mic drop.
You guys got anything else on 12?
No.
I
just found that interesting that we're just watching that and then we just
and then it comes right up.
Yeah. Well, obviously, it's the first mention of it, the two towns.
All right. Well, let's jump into 13. Well, I do want to say this, too. Obviously, the same thing. This actually is kind of interesting because it talks about the plagues, whatever they were. If it was impotence, like you said, or could it have been other plagues like we saw later in Exodus? And this is kind of a foreshadowing showing how great God is and the power he has over Egypt and things of this nature, that somehow maybe the Pharaoh in Exodus historically knew that plagues like this had happened before from the God of the Hebrews. And maybe he knew that. And even though it says, you know, God hardened his heart in certain places, God was trying to prove a point at certain, you know, there's a way that God teaches us. But even the second Pharaoh could have known, look at, he's already done this once. He's done this once. He did this, you know, back in, I don't know how many generations that was, but the distance back, he's already done this once before, and the God of the Hebrews has done this to us before. He could do it again, and he did, and he does. Nothing new under the sun. You see it happen again.
Mm-hmm.
I just think that's kind of interesting too. But I, once again, we don't know exactly what the plagues were. Impotence would be a terrible plague.
Yeah.
Especially back then when you talk about the importance of procreation to grow your nation.
And the fertility rites, all of them, you know, was into the fertility worship and the sexual mm-hmm. rites and all that stuff was intertwined with that. But Mike even said the same thing about when the Philistines stole the Ark of the Covenant and they were hit with plagues mm-hmm. until they finally returned it back and then they give them these gold in return. He was saying that through his studies that he believed that it was impotency or some boils on their private parts, something to do with their private parts, and that they made golden phalluses, and that was what the gold that they give, because it was like, you know, that was their way of trying to lift the curse off of themselves. Well, they mimicked and made a bunch of gold phalluses and sent it with the ark, you know, as payment to wash away their
phallus
issues.
Troubles. Their phallus troubles.
Yes.
We're going to melt that down, guys. We're going to turn that into something else. Yeah. We're just not leaving a bunch of gold phalluses in the temple.
We'll have a golden calf 2.0, guys.
Jeez. I wish we'd have gotten to talk to Heiser so much, because he just was such an incredible guy and his insight is far beyond ours. I do recommend you guys go and listen to the Naked Bible podcast if you have time. What he does and breaks down, knowing the language the way he did, he gets so much. And what we preach all the time is context. And boy, does he give you the context. And it helps you understand things so much greater. So jump into that Naked Bible podcast at some point. It's just so well done. All right, jumping on to chapter 13. So Abram left Egypt and traveled north into the Negev, along with his wife and Lot and all that they owned. Abram was very rich in livestock, silver, and gold. And from the Negev, they continued traveling by stages toward Bethel, and they pitched their tents between Bethel and Ai. There they had camped before. This was the same place where Abram had built the altar, and there he worshipped the Lord again. Lot, who was traveling with Abram, had become very wealthy with flocks of sheep, goats, and herds of cattle, and many tents. But the land could not support both Abram and Lot with all their flocks and herds living so close together. So disputes broke out between the herdsmen of Abram and Lot. At that time, Canaanites and Perizzites were also living in the land. Finally, Abram said to Lot, let's not allow this conflict to come between our herdsmen. After all, we are close relatives. The whole countryside is open to you. Take your choice of any section of land you want, and we will separate. If you want the land to the left, then I will take the land on the right. If you prefer the land on the right, then I will go to the left. Lot took a long look at the fertile plains of the Jordan Valley in the direction of Zoar. The whole area was well watered everywhere, like the garden of the Lord or the beautiful land of Egypt. This was before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. Lot chose for himself the whole Jordan Valley to the east of them, and he went there with his flocks and servants and parted company with his uncle Abram. So Abram settled in the land of Canaan, and Lot moved his tent to the place near Sodom and settled among the cities of the plain. But the people of this area were extremely wicked and constantly sinned against the Lord. After Lot had gone, the Lord said to Abram, "Look as far as you can see in every direction, north and south, east and west. I am giving you all this land as far as you can see to you and your descendants as a permanent possession. And I will give you so many descendants that like the dust of the earth, they cannot be counted. Go and walk through every land in every direction, for I am giving it to you. So Abram moved his camp to Hebron and settled near the oak grove belonging to Mamre. There he built another altar to the Lord. And that's chapter 13.
So that Oaks of Mamre, that was Shechem, right? That's where he built the first altar.
I think.
Because it said that he stopped in Shechem at the Oak of Mamre and then built an altar there. That was his first stop up in northern Israel. Then he went further south into the land of Canaan. I thought that was striking. I heard someone just the other day talking about this, and they said that this is a reason why there was a divide between like the priestly class and stuff, because they believed the mountain of God, Zion, was Shechem, was in Shechem at a certain mountain, because that was the first place that Abraham had built the altar and heard from God and all this kind of stuff. And then what was it? When David took the ark, how that one guy died, and he's like, oh, well, we just need to leave it here. He left it in Shechem. And then later, David took it on into Israel after a certain time. But there was a scholar, I think it was Ed Mabry, now that I'm thinking about it, but he was talking about there was kind of like a divide, like in the priestly class they were fighting over, you know, which was the dwelling place of God. A lot of Hebrews thought it was Shechem because that's where Abraham built the first altar. And then there's another half that says, no, it's in the southern states. You know, it's down here in Jerusalem, modern day Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Well, I Googled where Hebron was.
Hebron. I don't know.
It's literally in the middle of Israel.
Hmm.
Like almost.
Dead center.
North and south, it's in the middle, and east and west, it's in the middle.
Like I said, look at the land as far as you can see in every direction. Yep. I'm going to give this to you. So it makes sense. He says it to him in the middle of Israel, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
It's and this is modern day Israel. Obviously, it's on Google Maps, so I'm looking at. It is southwest of Jerusalem.
Now, some cool stuff. We do see Lot goes down and settles near Sodom and Gomorrah. And it already says those people were extremely wicked. So Lot knows that from the get-go, just later.
Yeah, we'll hear about that later.
But it also says, and it's in parentheses in my Bible, it says at that time the Canaanites and Perizzites were also living in the land. So we're starting to see them talking about these different clans, which I think get even more important in the next chapter. But we're seeing these clans, and these are the giant clans that we talk about that were part of the there was the Rephaim, and we see these other clans that had all, you know, even the Philistines, you know, have Goliath and his brothers, but there's these giant clans throughout Canaan. So when they send in the 12 spies, you know, we have Joshua and Caleb being the two that come back with the positive reports. The other 10 are scared out of their boots, but they're talking about, we are as grasshoppers in their sight. You know, these guys were giants.
Cannibals. The inhabitants devour the people of the land,
which is, kind of a post shadow, I guess. I don't know how to put that, but I mean, this is what happened in the book of Enoch when we're talking about the initial Nephilim, right? They devoured the people and everything in the land. So this is nothing new, right? Nothing new's under the sun. We saw this happen before. However, the Nephilim, excuse me. However, the Nephilim got through the flood. However, they showed back up. Those giants were there. And they were still repeating the rituals and the things that were done prior to the flood. It was still happening. And I think that we gear up to see some cool stuff here in a little bit. But I think there's never a coincidence that something's dropped in the Bible like that. But us telling us the Canaanites and the Perizzites are there. And you obviously, the land of Canaan and all of Exodus is about getting back to Canaan. And the
going back
land.
To Noah, you know, when his rebellious son Ham
slept with his wife and impregnated her. And that's why he said, cursed be Canaan. A servant to thy brothers ye shall be. So that's why they were a cursed lineage. It was from an adulterous and incestuous act.
Yes. That's pretty great. It's crazy. You see this stuff. I'm telling you, you watch Game of Thrones and think it's interesting. Read the Bible.
Yeah.
Just read the Bible and blow your mind. So
it also says in 15, I'm giving you all this land as far as you can see to you and your descendants as a permanent possession. Mm-hmm. So obviously they were scattered, you know, and then was it in the 40s or whatever it was, they declared Israel, then all the Jewish people come back. I just found that. Where it says a permanent possession. Mm-hmm. So therefore, they might have been scattered at one time, but it was still theirs. That was, I guess, gifted, if you would call it gifted back, but gave back to them as a nation.
Yeah. Was it 1920s? I don't remember.
20s, 30s, 40s, somewhere in
1947.
There. I think it was after World War II, right in that
I don't
time.
Remember.
I don't remember.
I think Israel became a nation. I think it was like 1947. That sounds right,
yeah,
right?
47.
That sounds right, yeah.
Sorry, I spaced out for a second.
I had to think about it for a minute.
That's just weird that brain it would fart. Say a permanent, where it would say a permanent possession. Like,
and we see it returned to them.
Yeah, yeah. Nothing, you know, it might have been stolen for a minute, but... Mm-hmm. They got it back.
But just a precursor before we go into the next chapter, because it's kind of relevant, how we were talking about giants and stuff. Well, the next chapter, in the very first verse, it mentions in the days of Amphriel, king of Shinar. When you get into even the book of Jasher, that story that I talked about in my book where Nimrod and Esau fought to the death for the supernatural garments from the Garden of God, when it was describing him, it said, you know, he was the mighty hunter, Nimrod. It says the same was Amphriel. Let's talk about this guy. And so right here where it says Amphriel, king of Shinar, it says Arlok, king of Eleazar. And I have in my notes here, it says his name is derived from the word RWK, meaning tall. And the Targums render him as tall among the giants. So he was a giant king.
Giant.
Yes.
I'm going to throw this out there, too. My translation says, instead of Shinar, it says Babylonia. Hmm. But in reference
Plains
to
Shinar,
the same thing,
yeah.
The Shinar, Plains of Shinar is where Babylon was. So either way, it's referring to the same
right.
area.
And to go back with what I was saying, just as you were talking it, come to me. So the permanent possession... What's going on in Israel right now? So Gaza, the Gaza Strip, was part of Israel at one time, and now they're fighting over it. And then you've got that other section, I forget what they call it, that cuts into Israel.
Jordan?
Not Jordan. Oh, what's it called? Can't think what it's called now.
The Crescent.
Which a lot of people think, I've heard even Kent Hovind talk about it. He was like, the land given to Israel goes all the way down into the Sinai Peninsula.
Mm-hmm. It probably
you get down
does,
into Jabel
yeah.
Laws, the mountain of God, where the Red Sea crossing. He said, every bit of these, that's where they dwelt for 40 years.
You can see that, too, in biblical maps from that time. If you look, and a lot of Bibles have them. I don't know if this one has it. But the area that was Israel was much greater than what present-day Israel is.
Yes. Yeah, extended all the way into the Sinai Peninsula, possibly all the way down to Kuwait.
Yeah.
Could be. And I'm just getting at that might be where all this, you know, fighting and all that kind of stuff's coming from, which obviously...
It goes back to the Ishmael.
You know, the devil's trying to take all their land, Israel's land. They're he's trying to... snuff them out.
But this is Isaac and Ishmael.
Oh, yeah.
That's where this is where it
the
stems
seed war,
from.
Man.
Who is the promised one that God, the promised seed that God promised Sarah He promised Sarah. He didn't promise. I mean, he promised Abraham the covenant, but he said Sarah was going to have that kid, and Sarah had Isaac.
Yep, and Sarah pushed forward Hagar because she thought that it was impossible.
It was her duty to give him an heir, so she pushed the cards. So back then, if you think about it, a woman, and you look through this, look at Hannah, right, who had Samuel. You look at other people, like when they're barren, they're an embarrassment to their family.
They're Sarah not a woman felt in that society.
That, yeah, she felt like she was not living up to what God had said she should be. So what she did was take matters into her own hands. She shouldn't have. She should have trusted God. But at that time in that culture, there's a reason why she did what she did. She gave Hagar to Abram because he's like, listen, your line's going to have to live on, but it's going to have to be through someone else because I can't have a child.
Right.
So she thought she was doing the right thing. Yeah. Wasn't a selfish thing. Wasn't anything other than she was trying to do for her husband what she couldn't.
Yeah. And Rachel was in the same boat later. Mm-hmm. Said that she was getting up there in age and she was barren, that the Lord had sealed her womb and went to the Lord in prayer and everything else. And then the Lord blessed and opened her womb. But yeah, I mean, you could easily put yourself in that position. You'd be freaking out. You're going to be tossed to the side. You're going to be replaced by a younger, more fertile woman and lose everything.
The West Bank is what I was talking
West
about.
West Bank, yeah.
I couldn't think of what it was. But all that at one time was Israel.
All right, one other small thing before we jump to the next chapter. I thought it was pretty interesting that they said right there. So Lot took a long look at the fertile plains of the Jordan Valley in the direction of Zoar. The whole area was well watered, like the garden of the Lord or the beautiful land of Egypt. So he's talking about the Garden of Eden. So now, does the writer, you know, is Moses saying, well, God told me to write about the garden, you know, it didn't rain, whatever, it was watered, but it was watered by those four rivers, right? Is he saying because of that, because of what he's heard, or for some reason was the Garden of Eden, even after the flood, still on earth? Because he's talking about it like people know what, you know, like at that time, like, oh, it was the Garden of the Lord, like, it's over there on this side of, you know, it's just to the east of Ur, you know, where Cain went, or Esau went and settled, right? So, like, could they still be? I don't know. I just think that's kind of interesting that they're talking about the, like, somebody's talking about that like it's a place at the time.
Yeah, and he compares it, I think, to Egypt because it, you know, if we believe that Moses wrote this, he was raised an Egyptian, and he knew the fertile silt and the floods that came and how they could just grow everything. And when there was famines up in the northern part of the Middle East, everybody came south to Egypt because it was the land of plenty.
Yep.
So even if it's just an analogy comparison, you know, that's probably the closest thing that they knew. That was, as far as the world that they knew, that was paradise.
Yeah.
You know, that was Florida, baby. Low taxes and a lot of jobs and
a great governor.
Yeah.
Chapter 14. About this time, war broke out in the region. King Amphrel of Babylonia, King Arioch of Elasar, King Chordalamer of Elam, and King Tidal of Goyim fought against King Bera of Sodom, King Bersha of Gomorrah, King Shinab of Adama, and King Shurmber of Zeboim, and the king of Bela, also called Zor. This second group of kings joined forces in the Sidon Valley, that is, the Valley of the Dead Sea. For 12 years they had been subject to King Chedorlaomer, but the 13th year they rebelled against him. 1 year later, Chedorlaomer and his allies arrived and defeated the Rephites at Ashtaroth Karnaim, the Zuzites at Ham, the Emites at Shavah-e-Kurtharam, and the Horites at Mount Seir, as far as El Paran, at the edge of the wilderness. Then they turned back and came to En-Mishpat, now called Kadesh, and conquered all the territory of the Amalekites and also the Amorites living in Hazazazan Tamar.
Come on, people. What's with these names?
Then the rebel kings of Sodom, Gomorrah, Adma, Zeboim, and Bela, also called Zor, prepared for battle in the Valley of the Dead Sea. They fought against King Chedorlaomer of Elam, King Tidal of Goyim, King Amphriel of Babylonia, and King Arioch of Elazar. Four kings against five. As it happened, the Valley of the Dead Sea was filled with tar pits, and as the army of the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah fled, some of them fell into tar pits, while the rest escaped into the mountains. The victorious invaders then plundered Sodom and Gomorrah and headed for home, taking with them all the spoils of war and the food supplies. They also captured Lot, Abram's nephew, who lived in Sodom, and carried off everything he owned. But one of Lot's men escaped. Excuse me. One of Lot's men escaped and reported everything to Abram, the Hebrew, who was living near the oak grove belonging to Mamre, the Amorite, and Mamre and his relatives, Eshcol and Aner, were Abram's allies. When Abram heard that his nephew Lot had been captured, he mobilized 318 trained men who had been born into his household. Then he pursued Chedorlaomer's army and caught up with him at Dan. There he divided his men and attacked during the night. Chedorlaomer's army fled, but Abram chased him as far as Hobah, north of Damascus. Abram recovered all the goods that had been taken, and he brought back his nephew Lot with his possessions and all the women and other captives. Let's take a break for a second, because the next section is a little bit different. That's a little more to talk about, but let's jump through here real quick and give my tongue just a break for a second.
Blah. That was some names, son.
That was worse than the Book of Enoch and the angels. Those kings had some unique names. The cities were some unique city names. And I don't think I got any of them right, so I apologize. But read it for yourself. Try it yourself. But going back in, these are the giant clans, right? We see the same thing. He talks about the Rephites. We know what the Rephites, the Zuzites, the Emorites, the Horites, the Malachites, the Amorites. We see all these giant clans. Now, we've talked about the Rephites or the Rephaim, right? We've talked about that before. There's a couple things that this is going to build up to something. I'm just going to prep you here. We're going to build up. So we're talking about the Rephaim first. And these other clans kind of fall into suit because these are all giant clans. Mm-hmm. But the Rephaim literally means shade, spirits, or ghosts, right?
And healer.
And well, it does. Yeah, it is. But when you look at it in the other context that's used throughout the Bible, yeah, it actually is used with the word matim, which just means dead ones. Mm. So it's often used. It's used in, here, I got a couple verses marked because I think it was pretty interesting. If I look at Proverbs, the where this word, and this is, so I'm reading it from my translation, so it's not exactly the word, but this is what it's associated with, it's synonymous with. In Proverbs 9:18, it says, "But little do they know that the dead are there. Her guests are in the depth of the grave." So we're talking again.
Rephaim, same word.
Rephaim, same word.
Rapha Isaiah, in the Hebrew, ain't it?
Yep. And then Isaiah 14:9. It says, "In the place of the dead, there is excitement upon your arrival. The spirits of world leaders and mighty kings long dead stand up to see you." Now, I know it says long dead, right? I think this, if we look at the context, we understand what they're talking about. This is the ones that are in Sheol.
It's the same one Jesus went down to and proclaimed victory to.
I think this is also, these are the same ones that that have not, these are the ones that were cast down, but the similar to the ones that are in Ephesians 6:12. These are the principalities, some of the powers from prior that were cast down, like Jude says, right, in everlasting chains until that day of judgment.
Mm-hmm.
So Rephaim, right, when we hear the word spirits, ghosts, all those things.
Shades, too, I think.
Shades. Shades, spirits, or ghosts. That's what it always refers to for the most part, unless it's talking just about that matim. The only other verse I have here, and I think it's interesting, is Isaiah 26:14 says, "We served before we are dead and gone. Their departed spirits will never return. You attacked them and destroyed them, and they are long forgotten." Now,
resurrection denied.
Yeah. Well, you see this, and if you look at what it talks about in the Book of Enoch, Shades, you know, we're talking Rephaim, shades, spirits, ghosts. Book Enoch says
demons.
That those spirits of the fallen Nephilim, we're talking about giant tribes here, Nephilim, are what is the demons and the of nowadays, right? These are the ones that thirst but can never drink, that, you know, that hunger but can never eat. These are the demons of present day. That makes sense. The Rephaim, it refers them as ghosts, shades, demons. This is the things that I think still haunt the world today, that possess things today. And I think we're seeing, so this is once again still building up, but we see these tribes talked about. Now you see that one of these kings, and you talked about one of the kings being called as tall even among giants. Yeah. So even these guys have giants in these armies.
Well, yeah, because they had to. I mean, they were fighting giants, bro.
They were
fire with fire.
They were fighting fire with fire, right? So these, we're talking four kingdoms against five, first of all, and then they come back, and they, after they win, they come back and they beat all these other tribes up. And then Abram, in Gideon-like fashion, with 318 men, takes on five kingdoms.
Yeah, the five kings.
Amphriel, Eleazar, Cordelamer, and Tidal. And Abram with 318 men, just like Gideon with 300 men against 50,000 Midianites. We see Abram with 318 men and have faith in his God take out four nations. I mean, that's more impressive than even the Gideon thing. We just kind of overlooked that.
If you just take the Gideon thing, say 500,000, so times four, so 200,000 guys.
Or 50,000 you meant. Not 500,000, 50,000?
Or 50,000, so 200,000, yeah.
But if you notice this, even Abraham had help from a giant clan. Because you go down here, it says... Then verse 13 says, then one who had escaped came and told Abraham the Hebrew, who was living by the oaks of Mamre, the Amorite, brother of Eshcol and of Anir. These were allies of Abram. So from the oaks of Mamre, the Amorite. That was his ally.
Now that's interesting. And that poses some questions there.
Well, even David's Gibborim. David's mighty men. There's a lot of people talk about that he had giants in his army helping him.
But that brings up a whole other
interesting. Now that's debatable thing. Because, I mean, the Gibborim is not a blanket term for giants, but it's a term mighty that's men. Often used to describe them. But it's not a one-shoe-fits-all thing. But people argue that, though.
Yeah, I can see that. I get that.
But at the same time, if you might be giant by genetics, but you might not believe that way. Your DNA might be, I'm a giant person, but I believe in God, not whatever my other fellow giants believe in.
Yeah, because even some of the lion-faced men joined with David.
I don't remember that.
I can't remember.
I'd say say. Say your great, great, great grandfather was a fallen angel, right? Over a period of time, your DNA, you know, that DNA, the first generation, you're 50% angelic and you're 50% human. This is the true Nephilim. Over time, as you breed with more humans,
you dilute the bloodline.
You're diluting the DNA, the bloodline. Now, does that, do you get to a point? I really don't know, because I think that's probably the problem when we go back to the flood, when it says the world was wholly corrupt. The word that talks about Abram being tamim, being pure, I believe referring to his blood, because
it's in his generations. He was tamim in his generations. So it's even talking about genealogies there.
So you think about that. That makes me wonder, like, how far would you have to be removed from that to no longer be... I mean, is it 1%, 0.0001%, you still have it? Does that corrupt you? I don't know.
Well, the Old Testament talks about, what is it, the sins of the father follow to the third and the fourth generation.
Yeah.
Might be something like that.
That's actually a good point. I don't know. That's a good question because you wonder that because you see this after the flood. You see many of those countries, and you do see some of those countries when Israel goes through and wipes them out. They'll wipe out certain ones. He says to wipe out everybody.
Yeah.
Other ones, he doesn't say that.
Yeah, he tells them just to pass by. Don't even bother with them.
Yeah.
You know?
But there's other. But at the same time, some of those people with them, it doesn't say that they're Hebrews or Israelites anymore, right? It says that they are, or not anymore. They weren't. It says there were foreigners living among them.
Mm-hmm.
So where do these foreigners come from? Are they part of those tribes? Are they intermingling with Israel? And at that point, if they're past that third or fourth generation, are these still having some of the giant characteristics and they end up being David's mighty men?
Possibly.
I mean, I don't know. I know that's such speculation, and I apologize for that because this is...
We have to speculate some.
This is going out on a limb here, but I just think it's very interesting because how does that work over there? Because if you go back to that time and you think about these giant clans over a period of time, these people... A lot of them just assimilate with other groups,
mm-hmm.
and they intermingle, and then they grow into different people. You know, we could talk about the Hyksos, right?
Yeah.
When the Israelites were in Egypt and the kind of the
rulers
crossing
from a foreign land, and yeah.
I mean, we don't know, but there's so many different things where we see assimilation, and there were some Egyptians that would have even left with the Israelites from Egypt. So there's so many different things that we can't. No, for sure, and that's why in the end, you know, this stuff is the non-salvation issues. This stuff is determine your faith. But I just think it's interesting to speculate, to think about, and try to dig in and look historically and see if we can find some answers for that. But I think it's interesting.
And if you go extra biblical, too, to the book of Jasher, you know, I think it was the previous chapter, or it was right after the Tower of Babel, when Abraham was called out, it said that he gathered all of his riches. That he had acquired and men that he acquired and all this stuff and his treasures and he left. The book of Jasher says that basically to avoid the wrath of God, Nimrod bribes Abraham just like the Egyptian Pharaoh did. You know, hey, have some goats, you know, have some gold, man. Just, you know, leave us alone. Mm-hmm. That Nimrod did the same thing, that Nimrod gave him livestock, gold and silver, and 300 strong men, 300 strong fighting men for security. And I thought that was pretty interesting when we got here. It said that he had 318 men. So if
it's just there's from
any,
his household.
Any water is to be held in that story, it ties in good here with Genesis, that some of those strong fighting men that he got from Nimrod when he left Haran.
That's an interesting connection.
That 300's kind of odd too, because then you got the Spartans with their 300.
Mm.
You know, later, obviously, way later. It's just that number keeps number of 300 ish.
Yeah, Gideon too.
It just keeps coming back.
A lot of symbology with the numbers and stuff.
So we need to build an army of 300 here at the.
Well, we got three. We just need the 100.
Oh,
yeah. We need a couple zeros. Anybody out there listening want to volunteer
to be a zero?
We need two zeros.
The dig army.
we need two zeros.
Two zeros, and we're good. All right, let's finish up chapter 14. We only got a few paragraphs here, and this is. I'm sorry. Verse 17. After Abram returned from his victory over Chedorlaomer and all his allies, and the king of Sodom went out to meet him in the valley of Shaveh, that is the king's valley. And Melchizedek, the king of Salem, and a priest of the God Most High, brought Abram some bread and wine. Melchizedek blessed Abram with this blessing. Blessed be Abram by God Most High, creator of heaven and earth, and blessed be God Most High, who has defeated your enemies for you. Then Abram gave Melchizedek a tenth of all the goods he had recovered. And the king of Sodom said to Abram, give back my people who were captured, but you may keep for yourself all the goods we have recovered. Abram replied to the king of Sodom, I solemnly swear to the Lord God Most High, creator of heaven and earth, that I will not take so much as a single thread or sandal thong from what belongs to you. Otherwise, you might say, I am the one who made Abram rich. I will accept only what my young warriors have already eaten, and I request that you give a fair share of the goods to my allies, Aner, Eskel, and Mamer. And that's chapter 14.
I just had a light bulb moment. What if this Aner and Eshgal, who said they were Amorites, you know, giant bloodlines, that they were his allies. What if the 300 strong fighting men that Nimrod gave to Abram, he just said, you know, hey, you're not my slaves. You know, I'll give you freedom. You can do whatever. But hey, if I need help, you know, you're going to be there when I call, right? Okay, cool. So maybe that's who these guys are. Well, once again, speculating.
They'd had to be from, because it says, back when it says the 319, it says from his household. So they would have had to have been, like you said, men that were with him, maybe ones that Nimrod had given him to fight for him, but they were just his allies in that land. I don't know. That's a
possibility.
Possibility.
It just kind of hit me.
Now, this brings up something we've hit on a lot before, but Melchizedek.
Yeah.
I mean.
Go back to the Doug Van Dorn show.
It is interesting.
I'm set in stone. That was pre-incarnate Jesus in my mind.
I believe that. Well, first of all.
Christophany.
Yes.
You have
That's
to look
a nice
at
word, ain't it?
Melchizedek.
Christophany.
And it says he's the king of Salem, which many interpret as the short for Jerusalem, Salem.
Yep. In peace.
And a priest of the Most High God. If you go later on into, is it Hebrews?
Oh, yeah.
And Hebrews says, you know, that Jesus is in the line of Melchizedek. And
who had no beginning nor end, no mother, no father.
Yeah, all these different things that this is
priest
not a,
forever.
This is
in the
not
order of Melchizedek.
A human being based on.
Got gooseies, man. Sorry.
Oh, you're good. This is not a human being based on what the Bible tells us. This is at minimum an angelic being, but most likely a pre-incarnate Jesus. Because what we see with what he does, first of all, he blesses Abram. But then what does Abram do? We
tithe.
See the first tithe he's giving back to the Lord. He gives a 10% of all that he had gotten.
And what's he break out? The bread and the wine.
The bread
just
and the
like
wine.
Jesus.
It's a foreshadowing.
Yes.
And I truly believe that there's so many different places we see this throughout the Old Testament. Melchizedek being just the one, but we see the angel of the Lord so many times. And that's that Doug Van Dorn episode we talked about that Justin said. But you see this so many times where you see not an angel of the Lord, you see the angel of the Lord. But you see Melchizedek, and then you see the description of him later in Hebrews when it breaks him down for who he is and the different characteristics of Melchizedek and how they're associating Jesus to Melchizedek. It's a very strong case to say that, and I don't think it's a stretch at all,
no,
to say that Melchizedek is pre-Jesus Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how else to say that other than pre-Jesus.
Yeah, pre-incarnate Jesus.
And I mean, it's pretty interesting because, you know, what's God's holy city?
Jerusalem.
Yeah. Yep. This is the king of Salem, the king of Jerusalem.
And he's the king and priest. It goes back to the stuff I talk about in my book, man. I hate to keep pounding it, but it's all through it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the priestly garments that Ezekiel 28 talks about, you know, every precious stone was your covering, beryl, onyx, topaz, jasper. That's the priestly ephod that the high priest wore going into the tabernacle. And what does it say? On earth as it is in heaven, the things on earth that God gives to his people to create, they are shadows and replicas of the heavenly things. So there's a heavenly temple. There is a heavenly garment that the high priest, you know, the king and priest of creation wears. And that's what Ezekiel 28 is talking about. And I think if you follow the extra biblical books, that was given to Adam when he was given dominion of earth. And all these books trace these garments being passed through the family, man. And it's the symbol of kingship and priesthood. And so it all falls in line to this order of Melchizedek, man. And it says in Hebrews beautifully, you know, he was a priest forever.
in the order of Melchizedek, who had no beginning or no end. So, I mean, it's spelling it out for you if you read between the lines.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what I'm talking about.
Oh, yeah. All right. You guys got anything else on 14 there? I think we knocked out, excuse me, three books really well. I think we hit on some good points.
Chapters.
Chapters. We knocked out three chapters again really good there. Man, it's good to be back in the saddle
with you
guys again. We've had a little time off, but we're going to get back going. Give you guys some more nuggets that we find along the way. And if you guys see something in these verses and that we didn't touch on, please reach out, say something in the Facebook group, jump on there, ask us questions. If there's something you want us to dig into, great. If you guys have insights, please post them on there. Let's talk about it. It's a safe place. Just ideas. The stuff we talk about, we speculate. It's fine. We sit there. It is a non-salvation issue. We don't want to lead anyone to stumble. That's never the goal. We just want to sit. We want to talk about these things, and we want to iron sharpens iron, strengthen each other's faith by looking at the scriptures and seeing the proof of who God is, who Jesus is, and ultimately the gift of salvation that we all have because of that. So thank you guys for listening. And as always,
keep digging.